to know when to say, I can't do this, I have to go away. And for elite performers, I think that's almost impossible. And I think a lot of elite performers have not just struggled, but failed and ruined their reputations because they weren't willing to say, hey, look, I just can't do it.
Welcome to Mindful Warrior Radio. Mindful Warrior Radio is a space we created to connect with incredible humans, to share brave stories, authentic insight, and real knowledge. My name is Cami Craig. I'm a former elite athlete, Olympic champion turned performance and culture design coach at Mindful Warrior. And I'm your host of Mindful Warrior Radio. Today on Mindful Warrior Radio, we welcome our guest, Alex Krongard. Alex served in the U.S. Navy for over 30 years, primarily in Joint Special Operations Commands and the Navy SEAL teams. He was a member of SEAL Team 1, 2, and 7, also including the Naval Special Warfare Development Group. Alex was the first commanding officer of SEAL Team 7, which he commanded in Iraq from late fall of 2003 to the spring of 2004. Later, he commanded Naval Special Warfare Group 1 with the responsibility for the training and readiness of the four West Coast SEAL teams and associated logistics and support units. Alex's final military jobs were as a counterterrorism director on the National Security Council staff in Washington, D.C. Alex retired in September of 2016 as a Rear Admiral, lower half. I'm incredibly honored and thrilled to tap into the insight of Alex on today's episode of Mindful Warrior Radio. Thank you, Alex, so much for your time today and joining us on Mindful Warrior Radio. As I shared earlier, I am beyond excited to have you on today and tap into your knowledge, your experience, and all of your insight that you have to share.
Okay, I hope I can live up to that.
I have a feeling that you will. So I was hoping, as I have shared in your introduction, you have a long and lengthy career with the U.S. Navy. You started as a Navy SEAL and then worked your way up the ranks as an officer, and you retired after 31 years. That is an insane amount of time in the military. And so I thought that we could start by you sharing a little bit about what led you into this type of work, a kind of a high overview of your timeline within your 31 years, and what kept you that long.
Okay, three big questions.
Yes.
I guess what I tell people, and I guess enough people know that I won't get in any trouble for it, but when I went to high school and college, particularly, I had like probably the best education America could offer at the time, maybe still, I don't know. And I enjoyed elements of it, but I just felt like I was looking for something completely different and, some challenges. I actually started with in the Marine Corps. During college, I went to 2 6-week programs with the Marines. And towards the end of the second 6 weeks between my junior and senior summers, I just got this feeling that I loved the Marine Corps, but I wasn't quite going to fit in with the Marine Corps. I had a different concept of leadership. And I was looking for something different, and I had met some SEALs, and I'd heard enough from them that I thought I can make it through this thing. So I signed up for the SEAL, the Officer Candidate School, and then follow on to Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL BUDS training. And I got to BUDS, and I felt like I had died and gone to paradise or something. It was so much fun to go to sleep at night, and all I had to worry about was, had I polished my boots, had I cleaned my uniform up, instead of had I read 3,000 pages of English, assignments, And it was just, I liked the lifestyle. And for the first, I don't know, 5 to 7 years that I was in, that kept me in. It not at the time, but now looking in hindsight, I was blessed that at about the 7.5 year point of my time in the military, I got in an incredible amount of trouble. And I was investigated for 6.5 months. And during that time period, I remember I did the book, What Color Is Your Parachute? And I wrote like a 28-page essay, which is kind of remarkable when you're like 25 years old. I think it was perhaps a bit grandiose. But anyway, at the end of doing all this process from the book, I found out that I wanted to be not just a SEAL, but I really wanted just to be a naval officer. I really liked it. And so I kind of took my punishment, which was, you know, probably it was a slap on the wrist, a little more than a slap on the wrist, but not much more. And I continued on. And then about every 5 years after that, a new reason for staying in would come in. And the longer I stayed in, the more I was staying in because I really liked the people I was working with. I liked the people who worked, you know, for me when I did have people working for me. And then 9/11 happens and it becomes almost impossible to get out with any kind of sense of, you know, having a moral core or, you know, pride. And so I stay in right after a couple of years after 9/11, I have a pivotal experience getting to start a new SEAL team and create a culture around it. We deployed to Iraq and it was just, it was an amazing experience. And I kind of felt like I owed something for that experience. So again, I stay in a little longer. I did some really miserable jobs at that time period, and but they were super learning jobs. They were just unbelievably painful when they were going on. After that period of time, I get to run the four West Coast SEAL teams. Nothing glamorous. It was all about logistics and support and training and that kind of thing. And that was a whole new leadership experience because the people underneath me were like what I would call definitive leaders with legally designated authorities. And it was a whole different kind of leadership then because of that. After that, I went to the National Security Council staff for 2 years working on counterterrorism policy in the first 2 years of the second Obama administration. And as I tell people, you know, I was there to serve the office of the president, not, you know, specifically President Obama. And I loved that job. It was the most different job I did in the military. It most difficult, the most intellectually challenging, but it was fun. I picked up Admiral while I was there. And as a reward for being there for 2 years and being an Admiral, I got sent to the country of Djibouti for a year. And Djibouti is in northeastern Africa, the Horn of Africa, tiny country, but very important in terms of U.S. basing. And I was the number two guy on a big task force. I think it was like 4,500 people or something. And we didn't have direct control over, I think, like 4,300 of them. And so you had to exert like, I'll call it cultural influence or something.
Yeah.
And then I had got my last job, which was up at AFRICOM in Stuttgart, Germany. And we were in charge. I was the deputy operations officer for all military operations on the continent of Africa, minus Egypt and a few like weird cats and dogs that were running around Africa.
Mm-hmm. And then you're sitting there at the end. This takes us through your whole 31 years of your career within the military at a really high level. What is the decision that eventually moves you out of this line of work?
I kind of like, when you become a one star, it's like you start a whole second career and they're kind of evaluating you for a bunch of different things to see whether you're going to go on or not. And I don't know what, I'm not sure exactly where I failed or whatever, but there was something I did that just didn't fit in, or maybe I just wasn't the right person that they were looking for certain jobs at the time. And I got offered, I think, a slate of 10 jobs. You know, if you stay in, you can have one of these jobs. And they were all jobs that they were interesting to me, but two things bothered me about them. The first was that they were at the I would call them the ragged edge of my knowledge and capability. They were things that I had not ever done in my career. And I didn't know that at 31 years in, it was time to learn how to do them. And the second thing was I wasn't allowed to choose which job. And I had already been away from my family for 2.5 years at that point. And so I said, you know, I think it's time to retire. I don't want to take the risk of being like in Hawaii, my family's in San Diego or DC or Germany or whatever. And so it made sense to me for the first time in 31 years to get out.
Got it. I'm curious of you went from, I'm going to go back to kind of the beginning, rewind the tape a little bit. So you went from being a SEAL team member to then being a first commander and leading a SEAL team, and then SEAL Team 7, and then a larger group of SEAL teams, right? But you go basically from boots on the ground to having to be the one commanding from the sideline, if you will. Does that land, or can you clarify that a little bit for me?
Yeah. My last job where, quote, boots on the ground.
Yeah.
Was let's just say it was roughly December of 1992. And then it would be, I would run or nominally be in charge, because sometimes I wondered if the inmates weren't running the asylum. But nominally, SEAL Team 7 was commissioned on St. Paddy's Day of 2002. And so that, that 10-year period, in many ways, that was where I paid my dues to get to it. In there, I would be like the number two guy at SEAL Team 2 for a year or so. But I did a lot of other jobs that prepared me to run SEAL Team 7. I had some of the most dangerous experiences of my entire career in that time as a staff officer. There's the old joke about bringing a knife to a gunfight. One time I was given a pistol and sent to an artillery duel. But those years, it was all staff work. And I learned a lot, and I watched a lot of other leaders lead. Those 10 years were absolutely essential, but they are, they sound boring. And when it came time to convince young SEALs to go off to staff work, they went kicking and screaming, and then they would come back and go, oh, now I get it why that was important.
Yeah. I was curious of what that transition was like to be kind of boots on the ground to then transitioning into staff work and then eventually back into this leadership role. What was that transition like, and what did you learn about yourself within that transition?
Well, the first thing, and this vary, I mean, I've had this conversation with a lot of guys, and it varies for people. As I was getting into my early 30s, my abilities as a trigger puller, or whatever you want to call it, were diminishing more rapidly than my experiential based, I'm going to call it wisdom, that may be too grandiose, was increasing. And I just found that the contributions I could make were way more like in the staff realm than they were, pulling a trigger. It was kind of embarrassing, but in Iraq in late 03, like December of 03, I went out with a group of, some of the guys working for me. And this one incredible guy, one of the higher ranking enlisted guys, pulls me aside and he's like, hey, you really can't go out with us because you're interfering. You just haven't trained with it. And I, said, okay. And they would find roles for me that I could fill, both capability wise and knowledge wise kind of thing. And so I would get out enough to know what was going on, or think I knew what was going on, but not so much I was endangering anybody. But I had to admit that I just wasn't as quick. And the other thing is, it's a lot, I needed a lot of training to keep my, move, shoot, communicate, patch myself up, skill sets up. Mm-hmm. And if I was doing I used to tell people the hardest thing I had to do in Iraq every day was go to bed at night, because the guys went out at night, did their ops. And in the next morning, someone had to come in and figure out how to take what they had done the night before. And one, sometimes clean up a mess, or other times, exploit an opportunity. And if I was trying to stay up 24 hours a day to do everything, you know, I wasn't doing my job. So I guess, you know, we were talking about it earlier, but you know, this goes back to that, you know, my Dirty Harry quote with a man's got to know his limitations. And I don't know that I accepted them as much as I kind of just said, okay, I guess this is the way it has to be, and grudgingly accepted them.
Right. Yeah. It's that acceptance piece, but it sounds like you were able to take that transition and kind of allow it to fuel you into these other roles and stay impactful and kind of learn a little bit different ways of making impact and leading throughout that time. When you transitioned off the team and you kind of went through this 10-year period, and then you started kind of overseeing these SEAL teams, you then filled this role of training and preparing the readiness of teams to embark on these missions. I'm curious of, from that experience and the repetition that you went through with that, what are some key things from your perspective that make you feel that a team is prepared and they are ready?
So the biggest one is, I hate to give such an imprecise answer, but you got to trust your gut sometimes. And so that, like, you trust your gut, you kind of get out and talk to people and listen, or more importantly, listen to people about what they're saying. I always found that I am not the greatest. There's some things that I feel perfectly confident and competent training people in, but moving, you know, basic skills are not my, I'm not that person. And I would try to find the best people I could, or enable and empower the best people I could find to train them. And then, trust the feedback I'm getting from them. And then in the SEAL teams, there's never any shortage of criticism available of people. And you have to kind of weed your way through what's real, you know, what actually matters is criticism, and what is kind of, you know, just sour grapes. Like, if you pardon my language, there's an old saying, you know, a bitching sailor is a happy sailor. And I added to that, a bitching sailor is a happy sailor, except really look at what they're bitching about, because sometimes what they're bitching about is a legitimate thing that, you know, isn't a source of happiness. And so I would leave my office door open. And if people wanted to come in and talk to me from like roughly 8 a.m. till 5 p.m. or sometime other, I would listen to them. And I found that over time, if you kept hearing the same things over and over again, you had to go kick the tires or turn over the rocks, whatever metaphor you want to use, and see, hey, what's going on? And do I need to do something here? And I just would, you know, I don't know, just kept an ear to the ground all the time. And believe me, I wasn't perfect. I made mistakes. I kept people in jobs too long at times. And sometimes I liked people who there were a couple of guys who were not that competent as, you know, tactical leaders, but they had other skill sets or attributes that made them valuable. And I would go with them and accept risk there too.
Yeah. Is there anything particularly that you were listening for? I think, like you said, just keeping your ear to the ground, you can start kind of hearing the things that emerge that may be problematic or disruptive, or the challenges that your teams are facing or leadership is facing. Is there anything particular that you would listen for that you're like, yep, that's, they're locked in, that's the right place? Like, what did you kind of open your ears and your mind to hear that you knew that they were locked in the right way?
The biggest, I wouldn't depend too much on whether they liked someone, but I was looking hard if they trusted someone. Mm-hmm. I met a lot of leaders that people, you know, they could not stand, but they trusted them. Yep. And as long as there was trust, I was okay. And then I also looked at people to make sure, I was looking at a team. And so if you had a really good, I didn't want to see an officer who was doing everything. And I didn't want to see an officer who was overly dependent on, you know, their senior enlisted guy. I wanted to see a team there where the officer knew what he was good at, or in some cases she was good at, with some of the support roles, or And I wanted to see a senior enlisted, like the platoon chief. I wanted to see them trust and have a good relationship with the officer. So I was looking for teamwork, really, more than any specific golden egg in terms of capacity or talent or whatever. And sometimes the most talented people are super problematic because they're micromanagers. And micromanagement, I have a real thing with. Like, one of my favorite guys who ever worked for me, I'll never forget, he told me, he goes, "You know, sir, I love the way you ran this organization, but when it's my turn, I'm not going to do it the same way." And that kind of hurt me. But then I realized that, I run it the way I run it. And, he's going to run it the way he's going to run it.
That's right. I'm curious of how would you define an elite teammate at that level? You said that you're really kind of seeing that the team is working together and you don't have to like your teammates, but as long as there's trust in place, how would you, from your experience, there's no wrong or right answer, but like, how would you define an elite teammate?
There were some guys, it was totally skill-based. Like they could just outshoot everyone. Like there was a guy who I served with from 91 to 92 who was just a freak. I mean, he could run, he could, bench or reps, well over 250 and run a sub 15-minute 3 mile and outshoot everyone, outjump everyone. I mean, he was an elite. I mean, by his numbers, let's say he was elite. Then there were other guys who, I'm trying to think of a good example. There were other guys who had almost like a mystical charisma about them, and guys would follow them anywhere and do anything. Yeah. And the key was to find out what each person's like super skill was and leverage it and also convince them to, do really well with their super skill and kind of work on their other stuff or compensate with it by having teammates who could, fill in where they weren't as good. But I've never seen, I cannot think of a single person, one who had it all, who could, do everything practically and leadership wise. There were some guys who were really, really close, but there's one guy in particular who, he was absolutely and utterly magnificent. But even he, after working with him long enough, I could see where his blind spots were, or weaker areas. But I think it's more just not thinking you're, perfect, that, and having some humility, I think that ultimately shows you who's the elite, who are the truly elite guys.
Yeah.
But that's a hard question. I have no idea.
It is a hard question. I think, from the type of teammate that I have been on different athletic teams, like the perfect teammate changes in each scenario with each team and, who are the new athletes coming in? Who are the athletes that have left? What is the needs of the team right now? I think there is like a few kind of standard things that are important when I think about my ideal or elite teammate. And a lot of it is around self-awareness, respect, and just that ability to commit. And that level of commitment, really trust starts to emerge when those actions and ways of showing up are met each day by those around you. And trust was another big thing. So this team cohesion and trust. So tell me a little bit about, I kind of want to see both sides of the coin, but like, how did you learn to trust yourself throughout kind of your training and in these kind of intense missions and the uncertainty and the unknown? Like, how do you learn to trust yourself? And then how does trust start to emerge collectively? Because I would imagine, I've experienced times where I didn't, for the most part, I would trust myself because the training and preparation prepared me for that moment. And that's what it was. Like, I was ready and I was going to trust that I could get the job done and I would bet on myself for it. Right. But there are days where I'm like, man, confidence is feeling a little shaky and I don't know if I wholly trust myself. And you got to lean on other people to kind of bring you up to that moment to allow you to be at that level of self-trust. And so I guess the question is like, how do you cultivate the self-trust? And then how do you cultivate trust within teams.
Yeah, I do not recommend following this, my prescription on this one. But I was blessed, you know, through high school and college sports by being, both academically and athletically in the bottom two-fifths of my, classes most of the time. And I just, I was with incredible people, and I kind of got this weird, pessimism-based motivation that somehow, kind of manifested itself. And then combined with that, in kind of a weird yin and yang type deal, I was just young and stupid enough to, just do blindly trust the instructors in training or whatever, to just go out and do things. Like, I can remember, I am neither a proficient parachutist nor a confident and happy parachutist. And I remember they took us at SEAL Team One. We went out back and we like spun around on a table and learned how to parachute with a parachute that didn't have a what I would call an optimal percentage of, openings. You had to, thankfully I never had to cut away a bad parachute, but anyway, it was problematic. And I'll never forget, I'm standing on the ramp in the back of the C-130 to jump out for my first parachute jump. And this old, this chief who had taught me, he just, we go out to the ramp and he just goes and kisses, blows me a kiss and sends me out the back. And something about that confidence in him, somehow I survived the experience. And, so early it was just trusting that I knew what I was doing and kind of being lucky enough to get through it. But over time, it was, understanding where my limitations were and being very careful, to prepare for things. Rituals had a huge role to play. Like before, yes, every time before parachuting, we have this sequence you would go through to check your parachute and rig and all your equipment to make sure it was on right. And somehow going through that ritual every time for diving or parachuting, that set my mind at ease and allowed me to do things. I will tell you, honestly, a lot of it was just terror of the worst thing you could do was screw up and hurt a teammate. And, I'll never forget, I had a parachuting, what they call a wrap, where I went out and another guy, when I looked up at my parachute, there were 2 feet in it and we were wrapped together and I was the lower guy. So I had to wait until he did something. And all I could think of on the way down was, wow, I'm the new guy. I'll probably get kicked out of the team for this. And, I didn't care. It could have been a fatal accident. No, I cared about the fact that I may have, screwed up and jeopardized the life of one of my teammates. And, yeah, and that had a huge part. And then I have to, later in my career, this, much later, actually, there was this guy, Buster Howe. He was a two-star Royal Marine from, the UK. And he gave us this great talk on trust. And he said, trust, I think I'll get this right, if you take reliability, add it to, so I can get, reliable, I can be relied on to get something done. Ability, I'm able to do it. And intimacy being, we can have a conversation about this and not pull any punches, and divide it by the perception of self-interest. So if someone can get nothing from something and they're going to do it for you anyway, and they're reliable, capable, and they're intimate with you, that's high trust. Lower trust is they're going to do it for you, but there's a lot of their own interest in it. And I found that it's really hard to apply in the real world, but conceptually it's amazingly helpful. And I find that has allowed me to understand trust in a whole different way. And trust in groups is built by repetition of, being reliable, competent, and intimate, and not, not just for me kind of thing. So not sure that answers the question, but that's my history with trust.
No, absolutely.
Oh, sorry. And self-trust, yeah, I deal with through pessimism. I just, I say, look, you're not that good at this, so you need to work hard and do it.
No, I think that's a wonderful answer. Thank you for that. I'm curious of, so creating kind of the repetition and training and the ability to develop trust within teams, how does culture play along with trust for you? And what role does culture have in developing a strong, successful team?
I mean, I care, you know, there's that saying, you know, culture's upstream from politics. And I think culture is upstream from everything. And I'll start with my favorite example that probably doesn't mean a lot, but there was this guy, Matt Jack Menendez. And when I was the number two guy at SEAL Team 2, I'll never forget, he walked into my office and they call the number two guy the XO, the executive officer. He goes, XO, you know, this place has so much tradition that if it's ever messed up, you just take your hands off the wheel and it will right itself. And that to me became the goal for building a culture of reliability and trust. And at SEAL Team 7, because we were a new team, we had no culture and we were formed from a bunch of, you know, pieces and parts from other teams. And we had this big meeting that I was not allowed to attend because I had to make the decision at the end about what our culture would be about. And it was funny. It was a really easy answer for the team. It took them a long time to get there, but it was, we wanted the professionalism of SEAL Team 1. It was mostly West Coast teams for really astute listeners. It was the institutional professionalism of SEAL Team 1, the operational prowess of SEAL Team 7, and the ability to have fun that SEAL Team 5 was known for. Those three things together, that's what we would be. I don't know if it was too soon to tell whether we became that. You know, I left a couple of years later, and I think culture takes like 5 years. But Absolutely. Some of the stuff we did culturally, and this comes back to how you can tell if you're successful in this, is I had these huge series of conversations with the guys who were working at SEAL Team 7 in Iraq in the fall and winter 2003-04 about changing some of the ways we did things, which were huge cultural changes. And the guys, I won't say they fought me tooth and nail, but I will say they asked really hard questions that we had to answer. And I go back to Iraq in 06, and there's another SEAL team there I'm talking about. And it's like, it's clear to me that most of the cultural stuff has taken root and is growing. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking to this young SEAL, and he's like, you know, this is the way we've always done things. And if anyone tells you different, they're messed up. And I'm like, I can't stop laughing, because I think one of the one, you'll get that argument. And two, you'll never get any credit. You know, the guys who worked hard to change all that, they, you know, everyone's forgotten their names and everything else. And everyone just assumes it's always been that way. And it's funny because SEALs are super conservative, way more conservative than they think they are. And, but when you finally convince them to change, they will change faster than anybody else I've ever seen. And, I just find it's all about talking to people. At the end of the day, it's about sitting down and telling people, hey, this is what I'm kind of thinking about doing. What do you think? And listening to them and kind of adapting the ideas accordingly and finding like that, you know, if you have 100 people you're conveying something to, there'll be like 8 that are on board and see it right from the get-go. And you just have to kind of make it, you know, 10 and then 12 and then maybe, you know, 2 years later, you'll get to 40 and they'll badger the other 60 to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting with culture. It's not something necessarily that you can measure or all the time physically see. And you have to trust that, you know, sitting down, listening, having the conversations, building a few bridges, having a few allies that are thinking the same way and feeling the same way and wanting to make positive change and healthy change in the same way. That it starts, like you said, take root and start to grow. What have you learned in that time of that period where you're not sure if it's taken root, but you're like enacting the new change or the shift in culture? What have you learned about that period where you're like, I don't really know if it's moving in this direction or not, or if it's the right direction to move, or you know, or what the outcome of this is going to be? What have you learned about that gap where there's kind of an unknown? What have you learned about yourself in that period?
Okay. The first thing is not about myself, but in general, I think it's a wickedly dangerous period because you have a whole bunch of different expectations and understandings about what's going on. And people will do stuff that they think is the right thing to do. And they're doing it with the, you know, they're honestly doing it because they think it's the right thing. Mm-hmm. You just have, so you have to be on your guard for, you know, things going wrong. If you hear even the slightest rumor of something like that, you got to investigate it and you have to make rapid changes. The second thing is, you know, speaking for yourself, is you have to appreciate that you may not be right and you have to be ready to change course or adapt, kind of thing. And I found that's really hard. And the military is, I think one of the most brilliant things the military does is the officer in charge of something almost invariably after a certain level has a very experienced enlisted person that works directly for them who kind of keeps them on track. I had a series of really amazing guys like this one in particular, who I still talk to quite frequently, but he kept me honest. And so finding that person who's going to, you know, go out and find out, you know, listen to the things and come back and tell you stuff, huge, huge thing. And then the other thing, and this can be really hard to do, is before you kick the first can down the road, and there'll be numerous cans you'll be kicking.
Sure.
You have to say, you have to write down somewhere, hey, this is what I'm expecting to happen. And then you have to hold yourself to it. If it doesn't happen, you have to ask yourself the hard questions. Like journaling, and it's hard to journal sometimes in the military because so much stuff is classified. Mm-hmm. But journaling is interesting because, you know, it's one thing to write something down, but the act of writing helps organize your thoughts, or it helps organize my thoughts. And the other thing is you go back 6 months later and you read what you wrote and you're like, wow, that's what I was expecting. And none of that happened. Mm-hmm. To be honest. So I know those are kind of the tool. And then just, you know, again, listening to people, other, you know, everyone you can. And sometimes if you have a good boss, sometimes your boss will be very helpful about, you know, giving you feedback. But I find invariably, you know, like my favorite reaction I ever got from a boss was I wrote this crazy brief about what I wanted to do one time. And my boss goes, Alex, that's an amazing brief and you're never allowed to give it again, but you can go do it. And so, you know, that kind of stuff's fun. But bosses are, you know, another resource that I think are underutilized.
Absolutely. Have you experienced teams in your leadership where you just felt like the culture could not set fire, that you could not enact change, that you could not get a shift going, and it was kind of like banging your head against a wall?
Yes. No, I mean, it's funny. I have found times where the problem was, you know, definitely me when I looked mm-hmm. in the mirror. I just wasn't the right leader for an organization, and I had to go away. And I found other times where I wasn't it's weird. It was a combination. I wasn't the right leader and the team wasn't the right team. You know, yeah. The team had problems in and of its internal to itself, disregarding, you know, my weaknesses. And then the other, so that's one thing, but the really scary one I've run into is like cultures that won't change. Mm-hmm. I mean, that like, no matter what you do, you cannot change the culture. And sometimes it's a lack of you know, you're not in the right place or the right job to do it. Sometimes it's a type of work is just the traditions are so set in stone
yeah.
that you can't do anything about it. And I think, and you know, you have to know when to say, I can't do this. I have to go away. For elite performers, I think that's almost impossible. And I think a lot of elite performers have not just struggled, but failed and ruined their reputations because they weren't willing to say, hey, look, I just can't do this.
Right. And this is not the right environment, the right team, or the right leadership to make this change at this time. Absolutely. Do you believe that you can influence or impact change in culture if you're not at the top of the leadership pool?
Yes. There's an army saying that you can change a battalion with the right captain. you know, and the captain's way down in the chain of command. And but it takes a very special kind of person. And usually they're the kind of people that you'll hear stories about. You know, they're very, they're the guy who, a man or a woman who you know is going to be, you know, in the military, general or an admiral one day. And I find they're pretty rare, but they do get identified. And the military is pretty good at times at accelerating them fast enough to get them where they need to be with time to do make change, but not so fast that they, you know, you start getting into Peter principle areas. But yeah, but I what you're talking about is rare. I think it's rare. And it also takes a leader who, one, isn't going to micromanage that person, and two, kind of will let them do what they're doing, which is the hardest part.
Yes. What have you found within teams the biggest disruptor to trust and culture?
I think premature success is, I've seen more tears shed over success than failure easily.
I
people who get put in jobs they're not qualified for, or they get put in before they're fully qualified, they will be qualified, but they're not qualified yet. There's all, unfortunately, like alcohol, I've seen has all alcohol and like, I forgot what the euphemism is for, like your relationship type issues.
Yeah. Distractions outside of the work that you're actually doing. Yeah.
And the wrong kinds of ambition, I think, I think ambition is an incredibly powerful tool, but there's, you know, blind ambition and stupid ambition, and that I worry about. And I'm trying to think of some, so, and sometimes it's just bad luck. You know, you're the wrong person at the wrong time and you get in trouble, or you're scapegoated. I mean, I've seen anything. There are 1,000 different ways that people run into, you know, bad things. And I think the sad reality of it too is, I think that good people, people will find a way to preserve good people, you know, a system. They may punish them a little bit, ever send them out. Most of the time, there's something else wrong and they take advantage of what bad happened. And I forgot one other thing I found in the military. And I think this is true in civilian, but I think it's more in the military. If you look right under a leader at like his or her primary advisors, I think more times than not, the right level, the right people at that level can keep a, nobody's perfect, and they can keep a leader in the straight and narrow. But some people become like a, it becomes a cult of personality, and they think their leader can do no wrong. And when they don't step in and be, you know, have a candid conversation, an intimate conversation with the leader, trouble. And that, when you look at the real downfalls of, you know, a lot of military leaders, I always look at that level below and say, you know, that person did not serve him or her correctly.
Right. Have you experienced in a leadership role having to kind of just take that ownership and accountability and state like, I messed up here to the team and hold that? And what was that experience like?
There was one time I wish I could have done it, and and this wasn't, I on a lower level, I did, I hate to say it, but it was part of a manipulative leadership tactic. You know, I had a guy who was super problematic and he was actively fomenting rebellion against me. And I said, I screwed up it, you know, so-and-so was right. And it was true to a degree, but the real reason, you know, I was led along the primrose path by this other guy. And, you know, I called it leadership by guilt. It didn't work, but you know, I was young and stupid enough to try it. And no, I accepted responsibility at times. I think there are people who think I didn't, you know, I've screwed up more than my fair share of things and, you know, tried to take responsibility, taken it, you know, everything on the spectrum. Because sometimes people won't let you take responsibility, you know, the higher ups, because it looks bad on them or, you know, whatever reason. Yeah. So I wish I had taken more, but, you know, I took what I could and, you know, failed in other places. So, you know, I'm an imperfect human being.
I mean, and that's the reality of being human. I'm curious if you have felt that it impacted the team positively or negatively when you had to kind of stand up and take accountability for it as a leader?
I think it does and it doesn't. Like at one level, they being people who work for you, like to see it. But on another level, they know the whole story and they know that,
yeah,
you know, there's a difference between being accountable and responsible for something when you did it. And there's another level when you're just the guy in charge. You were in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right.
And I think, I don't know, I think you get credit, but they want to see the person, they want to see contrition too by the people truly who did it.
Yeah, that's right. I'm keep laughing in my head. I was in my last year with the women's US national team. We had a long week of training. We're at the end of training and our coach had made a time change on our following like practice, and it wasn't in the calendar and it was a half an hour difference. And I just blanked on the change. And so I ended up being like set for course for being 30 minutes late to practice. And I get a phone call on the way to training and it's my teammate. And as I see her name pop up on my phone, I already know that I blew it. Like I already knew I was going to be late. And then like, no matter if there was no traffic, I was going to be about 30 minutes late. So I'm thinking like, can I sneak through the back door? Can I actually cut this time? Can I make it so it doesn't, that my head coach doesn't see it? No. So I give him a call. I said, "Hey Adam, I messed up on the time. I'm going to be about 30 minutes late. Start. I'll join you guys as I get there." And I show up and I figured they'd already start kind of their warm up and, please don't hold practice for me. And the girls are all just chit chatting in the weight room and they're giggling. And I'm thinking like, what the heck is going on? And I walk in and it's kind of like, as soon as I walk in, they're like, "Shh, shh, shh, she's here. She's here." You know, that's good, like kind of the whispering and stuff. And so they're like, "Have you ever heard of kangaroo court, Cammy?" And I was like, "No, I haven't. What is that?" And basically, like, we get to pick your punishment for being late. Like, I am always on time. I am a veteran leader on the team at this point. Like, I'm constantly holding the behavioral standard for the team and like the ultimate professionalism, right? So like the fact that I was late was killing me personally. And now my younger teammates are holding kangaroo court and choosing my punishment for me. So I walk in and, I say, "Sorry, you guys, I dropped the ball. It's my responsibility," so on and so forth. Like, I'm pretty embarrassed, like, my bad. And so they start throwing out all these ideas. "We're going to take your stipend for the month. We figured you could do like a test set. You have to carry all of our bags," or just like all of this like ridiculous stuff. I'm thinking like, I'm like pretty pissed at this point, more at myself than them. And then finally one of the girls like had spoke up and she goes, "We figured that was the worst 20 minutes of your life, in the car being late for practice. And we're just gonna write it off. So thanks for taking accountability and let's keep it moving." And I was just like, that is where the trust and the respect comes in, and putting in the time over and over again up into that point and taking that ownership. But I think it was a positive impact. No one lost any respect at that point. No one had thought any less of me. Like, I blew it. I slipped through the cracks and they basically caught me and said, "Let's keep moving." So I think about that story as we talk about these topics.
But, it's funny because you bring up something like one of my like pet rocks, which is I have not, like what you talked about, accepting responsibility. That is something that every leadership, it is a part and parcel of most leadership, curricula or that kind of thing. The thing I wish that they would teach more, if at all, is how do you treat people who screw up?
Mm.
I find that, screwing up is, when someone screws up, it's also a huge opportunity to move the ball forward in all kinds of ways, mostly cultural.
Yep.
And I find, people, they immediately go to the scream at them or the, what punishment we can get. Like, your story is magnificent because it was the perfect punishment and it was brought cohesion to the team rather than divisiveness. But I have found more often than not that people don't know how to treat people in trouble, leaders. And it's a huge skill set, and it's one I wish was taught. And I'm going to say taught, period, because I don't think it is.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And what is the benefit of, not having a culture where you can just make mistakes, but like, what is it to be able to make a mistake and be able to learn how to recover from it quickly and seamlessly and move forward. You know, that's the difference between being led in fear versus being led with kind of standard and expectations. And everybody knows when you're fearful, you're tighter, you're more rigid, you're not thinking as clearly, and you're more apt to make repetitive mistakes or continue to make mistakes and large mistakes. And so what is it to actually be able to have the space to make mistakes and recover from it?
Yeah. And that's, you got to define, someone has to define that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, and a little bit to what you were speaking to early is how does each individual respond to it? You know, some people go into full paralyzed, some go into full frantic panic. Some have figured out how to regulate themselves to say, oh shoot, I made a mistake and you're not going to be happy about it, but I can find and navigate my way through this. So yeah, I agree. And I think healthy mistakes is where you earn your experience and where you learn your lessons. And hopefully, you know, the plates aren't being broken on the ground or thrown on the ground as you're doing it, right? And it doesn't cost you too much. I remember I was named to the 2012 Olympic team, and I told the head coach, and I said, you know, I was crying. This is so great. Thank you so much. And I said, but I want to say this. And he was like, what? I was like, I'm going to make mistakes at the Olympics. He's like, I know. And I was like, I know, but I just need to tell you, I'm going to make mistakes. The goal is to minimize them and make them like not as frequent as possible, just to make, but I'm going to make him. He's like, I know, Cammy. I was like, okay, thanks. But I'm just like left his office. But like this idea to create just a little bit of space to be imperfect was really important at that time for me, for whatever reason. And it's a part of that ability to kind of make the mistake, know that you've got backups and keep pivoting through it. And knowing that you have teammates, like that's the whole benefit of being on a team and having people who have strengths where your weaknesses are.
Yeah, my favorite leadership story of all time, like in my personal experience was, I was in a command or on a staff once, and to say I was the odd man out would be like the understatement of the year. In other words, say within 2 weeks of getting there, they were trying to send me away, you know, because I was just pissing everybody off. And I don't know, like 6 months into this, this one guy, Bob, he said, he gets everyone together in our little group, and he says, all right, we're like a football team. And he says, you know, you two over there, you're the quarterback, you're the star wide receiver, you know, so-and-so, you're the outside linebacker. And, you know, he goes on, and everyone's like interior lineman. And then he gets to me and he goes, Alex, you're the special teams. And whenever anything happened, I was never allowed in the room when they did planning because I just gummed up the works. And every so often they would hit like a roadblock or something, and they'd go, and someone would come get me. I'd come in the room and I'd sit down and they'd say, okay, this is what we have. And this is where we're having some problems. And I'd be like, you know, have you looked at this, this, or this? And they'd say, okay, get out of here. And I would leave again. And that was the best team I was ever on. And oddly enough, one time by accident, we were in a situation where me and this other person who was in a similar position in the Intel specialty, and we were the only two people there. And so we put together a team of all, it was like the Island of Misfit Toys. And we planned something, and they got the A team got back and they looked at what we had planned. And they're like, wow, this isn't the way I would have done it, but this is pretty cool. And we'll do it this way. And personally, I didn't get along with all those people. I think personally, they didn't get along with me, but we were a good team, a good solid team. And it was all because of this one guy's insight and slotting us and letting us each know what role we played on the team. That was pretty cool. I've never only had it in 31 years. I had it happen one time. So
would you say that that team was able, based on kind of understanding the strengths and weaknesses and kind of clarifying roles and responsibilities and being thoughtful about how you guys utilize that, would you say that you experienced flow on that team?
Yes. I mean, because it was all, we just didn't use people the way they didn't want to be used, and which, you know, made people happier and it made everything flow. Like we did some things where it was so out of my lane that all my only job was to come in at a certain time and make sure a guy went to bed. I mean, that was my role. But oddly enough, getting this guy to go to bed, you know, he would just work until he dropped on the computer. You know, that was an that was a crucial thing. But it, yeah. But and then I don't know. It's just fun to be on that team. It wasn't fun in, you know, like for the first year, but and then it became fun.
What role does fun play in? I mean, I would imagine everybody looks at Navy SEAL teams and, I mean, in the worlds that you have exist and led in and worked within, you know, it's pretty high stake, high risk. I'll just kind of have this be our wrap up question here, but I'm curious of what role did fun play for you throughout your time in the military?
Well, I like dark, you know, black humor, hugely important. Abuse, like verbal abuse to people, like when people screw something up and, you know, drawing immediate attention to it. And like there were various training things you had to wear, like different, like stupid hats and things like that if you screwed up. And I think it was what kept everything, you know, that it lubricated everything and it allowed like constructive criticism in a way that, you know, was that remained constructive and no one, you know, didn't become abusive. Hazing, which was at the beginning of my career, but, you know, was dead by the end of my career. Hazing played kind of a role in that, but, you know, I think hazing has a tendency to go off the rails really quickly. And so I, you know, it's not like I miss those days or anything, but the dark humor stuff, it's the one thing that I have found most problematic about coming out of the military culture is that business just doesn't have a lot of dark humor and people look at you like, I was at a meeting with an investment banking and we were talking about, you know, our value proposition and my value proposition. I was joking. We were all sitting around a table and I said, well, my value proposition is, you know, I don't know much about banking, but, you know, I can understand people. And, you know, I think the people understand that if whoever I'm with screws up, you know, I'll kill them. And you could literally see people moving away from me at the table. And I was like, guys, I'm joking, you know?
It's a joke, and, you guys.
And there was no laughter. And, but it is what, it's a bonding.
Yes.
Corrective mechanism, you know, it's some sort of, you know, there's a, or like a creative tension there and it was fun. And I don't know that that's the one thing I would throw out there is the black humor thing. And I don't know how you could do a lot of the stuff in the teams. Like the one of my favorite ones is, you know, you're out there and you're freezing cold and you go, oh, at least it isn't raining. And I was actually, I went on a hunting trip after I retired. And I'm with this friend of mine and we're up in the mountains in Northern California and it's freezing cold. And I said, oh, you know, at least it's not raining. And damned if it didn't start raining. And, you know, and I'm just sitting there laughing. My friend wasn't.
Yeah. But you have to make light of what you're doing. It's intense. And it's like, if you can't find a crack of joy in it or humor or fun or playfulness, then it's, I don't know how it's possible to do it. Like you said, it keeps things moving. And I think it is an element to the bonding experience. It's a part of what creates trust. And it's a part of what creates culture is somehow injecting fun and joy and an element of play into the work that you're doing. Otherwise it would just be purely miserable. And I don't know how you could get through it.
No, you couldn't. I mean, that's,
there's no way.
No. So,
well, thank you so much for your time today. And your insight. I greatly appreciate and enjoyed this conversation. I'm looking forward to sharing it and, is there anything that you'd like to share as we wrap up here? Any kind of final thoughts or words?
No, the only thing is don't try this at home, but
yeah,
you know, it's, you know, I don't speak for the whole SEAL team. This was that was my experience. That was my, you know, what I gained from it. And, you know, there's many different ways to lead as there are people. And, you know, I guess the last words of the Buddha, you know, seek your own salvation with diligence. I mean, everyone's going to seek their own way of leading. And you just, if you do it diligently, I think you'll be successful.
Thank you to those who've joined us today. If you enjoyed today's episode, please take the opportunity to share with a friend.
follow Mindful Warrior Radio and leave a review. To learn more about Mindful Warrior and Mindful Warrior Radio, please follow us on Instagram at The Real Mindful Warrior and check out our website at www.mindfulwarrior.com. I look forward to our next discussion here on Mindful Warrior Radio.